The passage which I asked to be read this morning, that passage in Matthew chapter 27, really focuses the message that I'd like to bring this morning. But I'd like to go back a fair way before that and ask ourselves the question, why was it that such a good man was crucified? Now that's the question that comes to many people. So many people would look upon Jesus Christ and they'd say, well, he was a good man. Why was it then that he was crucified? Well, I suppose we could give what you might call a theological answer. That is, a reason, a doctrinal reason, relating to the bases of our faith. Why was it that Jesus died? I was at a church last Sunday where they sang that hymn, "There is a green hill far away." And one of the verses of that hymn is something like this. There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in. Why a good man had to die was that there was no other good enough. No other good enough to pay the price of sin. And if I can adjust the wording of that song to give it a little more theological body. There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could pay the penalty for sin. There was a purpose to Jesus' death. It was not simply an accident. It was not simply that he was a victim of circumstances. There was a definite purpose in the whole thing, that there God was dealing with the whole matter of sin which had entered the human race. God's penalty for sin was death. Breaking of his law carries with it a penalty, and he is the judge. And the penalty was death. Yet God in his love didn't want man to perish in his sin, and so God himself provided a way whereby man could be forgiven. And so Jesus Christ came, and he died willingly to pay that price. And he was the only one who could do it, because he was the only one good enough, because he was the only sinless one. Now anybody else who himself was a sinner would, by that fact, not be able to take the place of others, because he himself would be under condemnation. You can't have one criminal paying the price on behalf of another. It had to be someone who himself was not under that condemnation, who himself was not liable to pay the penalty. Jesus Christ was the only one good enough, because he was the only one perfect, he was the only sinless one. And he became man so that he might bear man's sin, pay that penalty, and so make a way whereby God could, both justly and lovingly, forgive those who wanted to be forgiven. God doesn't just sweep sin under the carpet, God deals with it. And if God is to forgive and be just in doing so, then it can only be if he himself has first of all dealt with the sin. And so that's why Jesus Christ died, that he might deal with this whole issue of sin. That's why the good man had to die, because there was no other who could have died. He had to be a perfect person to take man's place. But I want to tackle the question now from another angle, and that is the angle that most people would look at it from, and that is not from the angle of Christian belief, but from the angle of the simple narratives of the story of which we've had a bit read to us this morning. And people in general around the place, they may not go to church, but they have some idea of Jesus Christ, and they know that he was a good man and that he did harm to nobody. Why was it that a good man like this had to die? Well, I'm going to suggest to you that once he had declared himself who he was, it was really inevitable that he was going to finish up getting executed. You see, Jesus Christ was God become flesh. Now, it's very difficult for us to understand how God exists. We know that God is infinite. He is unlimited by time, by space. He is somewhere. He is everywhere. And so it's very difficult for us to get an idea of God, because anything that is abstract, anything that is not concrete, it's rather difficult for us to grasp. For example, you try and define the word truth. We know what it is when somebody speaks the truth, and we know what it is when somebody doesn't speak the truth. But just to define the general concept of truth, it's an abstract idea, it's rather difficult. Try to describe the word beauty. It's a very difficult thing to describe, unless, of course, you can describe a beautiful thing. You see, the abstract idea comes down to something concrete, and then you can understand it. You try to describe goodness. Just go about a philosophical pursuit for yourself and try to define goodness. Very difficult to do. But of course, if you know a person who is good, well then, you can describe it in terms of that person. So these abstract things, if they're concentrated in something concrete, we understand them better. So it is with God. God is beyond the understanding of man because he's infinite, he's beyond time, and he cannot be limited by space. The very nature of God being that, we find it difficult to understand. But let us suppose now that God became man. Let us suppose that God focuses himself in something concrete, a person with bones and body and flesh, and he walks around the place here on this earth, and so God is focused in that person. Now that in itself, apart from being the miracle of all miracles, is going to involve a tremendous, if I can put it this way, scaling down of God. Now don't get me wrong here. This person is in fact God, the complete God in human flesh. But the very fact that he is in human flesh means that he could not be a full expression of God. He is fully God, but there's something limited about him, because he is God, as it were, scaled down to fit into a human form. But he's no less God than he was before. But when you see that person, you can see what God is like, and you see how God handles life in the same sort of world that we handle life in. Let me give you an illustration to get this point across. How this person can be God, fully and completely God, and yet at the same time not be the full expression of God because of the very limits which he accepts. Supposing I'm standing out here somewhere on a lookout, and there's a view before me. I look out over the valleys, and there's hills in the background, and trees down here, there's a river, there's a house, there's some cows grazing in the fields, and the beautiful scene just stretches out before me for 20 or 30, 50 miles. And I take out my camera and take a photo of it. Now when that photo comes out, it's very small. It's about this big. And yet that is a complete image, a perfect image, you might say, if I'm a good photographer, of what I saw. The mountains are there. Camera doesn't lie. The mountains are there. The trees are there. The river's there. There are the cows in the field. There's the house with the red roof in the corner. It's all there. But of course it's only in two dimensions. And it's only this big. And yet it is a complete representation of what was out there. But the very fact that that vast area has had to be focused through the lens of a camera into a little bit of stuff this big means that this little thing that I've got, although it is an exact reproduction, and it's a correct reproduction, by the very nature of it means that it cannot be a full expression. For example, that scene takes up umpteen square miles, whereas this thing I hold in my hand takes up only a couple of square inches. And so although it is a correct image, the very fact that it is limited to that size means that it can't be a full expression of what I actually saw out there on the mountaintop. Now this is the way it is with God. God, as it were, is focused in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is completely and utterly God. There's no limitation whatever in his Godhead. But yet the very fact that he is a human being means that he is not a full expression of God. Because, as I said before, God is everywhere. Now, a human being can only be in one place at one time. If he's to enter this scene, he's got to be born somewhere. Now, we know that God wasn't born. We know that God has existed forever. But if God is to enter the stream of human life, then he has to be born in a certain place. He's going to live in a certain country. He's going to speak man's language. Not every language, but the language that happens to be the language of the country he lives in, and perhaps one or two languages round about. He's going to eat the food that men eat, and he's going to live the sort of life that we live. Now he's God. He is God focused in that one person. Just like that enormous vista that I saw was focused in a small piece of film, accurately, completely, so God is focused in this person. But the very fact that he is a person means that he can only be in one place at a time, and he is going to suffer the normal limitations that you and I suffer. That is, he's going to be hungry at times. He's got a digestive system that's got to be fed. He's going to grow. He's going to start off as a baby. He's going to grow into a boy, into a youth, into a man. And he's going to go through life experiencing the sorts of things that we experience. Now let's just think to ourselves, what are some of the reactions that we're going to expect if a person like that suddenly appeared among us? Well, I guess there'd be many reactions, and I've summarized them just under 3 points. I think the first thing that we'd find people thinking is that this person, this God focused in this human being, this person was not really man. He's only God pretending to be man. And that, of course, is the way many people would expect him to be. If, of course, he did appear as an ordinary man, a well-adjusted human being that walks around and does things the same as the rest of us, you could well imagine that many people would say, wait a sec, this is blasphemy. I mean, God can't be like that. Oh, yes, God can be like us to some extent, but he couldn't be completely like us. But if God was going to be focused in this person, then he's going to be completely like us. And so he just lives the sort of life that we live, you might say. He gets up and he makes a cup of tea in the morning, and he has his cornflakes. He goes to work and he gets a bus and he has to wait for the bus like anybody else. He buys a newspaper to find out what's going on around. He knocks off for morning tea and he has lunch and he comes home and he's tired and he sits down and takes his shoes off and hopes to have another cup of tea to ease the tension of the day. And then maybe he's tired and he nods off as he's watching the TV at night. Things like that. Now, if the person was like that, they say, wait a minute, this is blasphemy. I mean, God can't be like that. And so you'd expect that if this person was going to be God in flesh, then people wouldn't expect him to be like that. They'd expect him to be like a man, but not really a man, just sort of God acting like a man. And if he wanted to get from here to Sydney, he could just click his fingers and he'd be there like that. And if he had a few people down here he didn't like, he could go, and he could atomize them on the spot. And if he was hungry, well, it didn't really matter because he could just make stones into bread and eat them and things of that nature. So if a person appeared as a normal human being, such as we are, you could expect that one of the reactions would be that people would say, look, this is not what God is like. And if a person living like this claims to be God, it's blasphemy. Now that, of course, is exactly what happened to Jesus Christ. They said, he can't be. Look, he grew up in this village. And he's been around for 30 years, and he hasn't been preaching or doing anything. We've known him. We went to school with him. His brothers and sisters are here. He worked in the shop. Look, we've just known him for 30-odd years, and now you're trying to tell us that this one is God. So you get the accusation made. Blasphemy. So that's one reaction I think we could expect if God becomes man. The second reaction I think we could expect is that this man would tend to challenge current values. He'd have a different perspective on things. Now, we gauge things according to progress. We look at the amount we're improving in our work, in our homes, in our churches, whatever we're doing. We're looking at how we're getting on. We're hoping that we're improving as we go along and that we're getting better off and better off as things move. We expect progress. We expect productivity. We expect gain. That's part of what it's all about. But if this man was God, then we'd expect that he was seeing beneath the surface of things, and that he was not so much concerned with the end product as with the attitudes which brought about that product. In other words, he'd be concerned more with motives than with measurable achievement. And so he's bound to run into opposition. He challenges the status quo. He rocks the boat. Now that's the last thing that people like. We all like to go along and do the right thing and do the same thing. There's safety in numbers. And then along comes one person who's a bit of a stirrer. Whereas everybody else is happy just to go along with this life that we've got, here is somebody that keeps on gumming up the works by saying, look, that is really not the most important thing. The ends are not the main thing. The means is important. For example, he might say things like this. You all go to church here, and you're all very friendly, and you have great fellowship. Well, that's marvellous, isn't it? And we're all very happy, and we're comfortable in each other's company. And that gives us assurance. And then he might say to us, look, that's no assurance at all. Because con men, they also mix in each other's company and they've got assurance. And they're friends with each other. And the prostitutes, they've got their own little group too and they all love each other. So the test of your genuineness is not whether you love each other, because obviously people of the same ilk like each other. The test is whether you like those who don't like you. And then you'll get people who'll say, I love God. Well, that's what we say, isn't it? We go along to church and we say, I love God, and we pour out our praises to God. And then he'll come along and say, yes, but you can't see God. Now, how can you love somebody you can't see? It's much easier to love somebody you can see. Now, that's fairly obvious, isn't it? It's much easier to love somebody you can see than to love somebody you can't see. I find it very difficult to love, let us say, Mrs. Thatcher or the Queen or Colonel Gaddafi, for that matter. It's very difficult to love somebody you can't see. He says, look, if you can't love the person who you can see, fancy ever claiming to love somebody you can't see. And immediately, we feel that somebody's pulled the rug from under us. Because we look around and we say, Yeah, there are a few people around that, frankly, I'd like to rub their noses in the dirt. There are people that annoy me, and frankly, I must confess I don't love them. And then we start to think that this sort of teaching is not very comforting, because we like to think we love God and we worship God, and then he comes along and says, but if you can't love the person who you do see, how can you claim to love the person you don't see? That sort of thing, you see. He is actually looking at the motives behind things, whereas we are all comforting ourselves in the externals, the way things appear to us, and it gives us great assurance. So he challenges the current values. He challenges the status quo. He's a bit of a radical, in other words. Not a radical in the sense that he looks decrepit and he runs around throwing rocks through windows, but a radical in the sense that he just doesn't go along with what popular opinion is, and he just doesn't support the status quo because it's respectable and what middle-class people should do. And so that's the second point, his challenge of current values. And the third point is the outcome of both of these put together, and that is that he attracts to himself a fair amount of opposition. And the opposition he's going to attract is going to be largely from the religiously respectable people, because they're the ones who have largely suffered under his criticisms. He has exposed the hypocrisy. He exposes their selfishness. He exposes their dishonesty at times. And they didn't think that that's what a religious person should do. He's supposed to go out on the corner and start preaching to all the drunks and all the hoods and hooligans and the people that are always creating strife in society. They're the ones you ought to straighten out. But we respectable people that go to the synagogue every week, or to bring it up to date, that go to church every week, we really are not the ones that are creating all the strife around the place. It's all those others that are creating the strife. But Jesus comes along and he penetrates below the surface, and so he says to these people, in your smugness, in your self-confidence, you are deceiving yourselves. And in fact, he says, many of those people that you despise as being the dregs of society, many of those are actually going to get into the kingdom, and you're going to miss out. And he says, when the final headcount comes, you may in fact find that there are more of those ex-prostitutes, hoods and hooligans and con men and the rest of it. You might find there are more of those in than there are of you. Now, you can imagine that people are not going to take this indefinitely. They had always been brought up with the impression that because they were religiously respectable, they were God's people. And they were not guilty of the gross evils that these other people were guilty of. But the thing is that many of those other people, when they heard Jesus speak, actually responded to what he said. Whereas these other people, the good ones, they didn't feel it applied to them, and so they didn't need him. And so the opposition came. Now, there are the three main responses I think you can expect. Firstly, that they wouldn't really expect him to be man, but only pretending to be man. And of course, if he did claim to be man and God at the same time, then they'd accuse him of blasphemy. Then the second one, that he would challenge the current values, and the third one, that he would attract opposition to himself. And so as he went around preaching like this, people started to get very annoyed with him. Not only uncomfortable, but plain annoyed. Now at the beginning, there were lots of people who listened to him, because he healed people, and he had teaching which was very easy to understand and very sensible. But as he kept going, and they saw what he was getting at, they became more and more restless. More and more, they wanted to get out of his way. They didn't want to listen to this type of preaching. They wanted to listen to the type of preaching they were used to. And so they tried to get out of his way. In fact, they had a better solution than that. They said, instead of trying to get out of his way, let's try and get him out of the way. And so that's exactly what they did. Because over several years of Jesus preaching like this, more and more the religious leaders got sick of him. And they saw in the long run exactly what he was on about. They saw that they were the ones who were the people that he was largely speaking of. He'd spent a lot of his time in the northern parts of Palestine, up around Galilee. The people in Jerusalem, which was the religious centre of the nation, didn't really get very enthused over him on the whole, and it was in Jerusalem that he ran into most of his opposition. He hadn't been to Jerusalem very much, as far as we can gather from the record that we have here in the Bible. Maybe only three or four times he went to Jerusalem during the period that he was carrying on his preaching and teaching ministry. But in the end he came to Jerusalem, and on Palm Sunday, as we call it, he rode into Jerusalem as the Messiah of the people, and he was welcomed by a large crowd of people. But it appears that those who welcomed him weren't entirely convinced, or didn't entirely understand, what he really was. They didn't understand his messiahship. They still seemed to have things a little bit mixed up. And as the week wore on, you find the number of enthusiastic supporters slowly but consistently dwindled. The religious leaders, on the other hand, said, oh, he's not back again, is he? Here he is, coming in here right on festival time, and stirring up this hornet's nest again. And so they challenged him on a number of occasions. And the more they challenged him, the more he silenced them with the arguments that he brought. With the result that they got angrier and angrier. They said, look, we just can't let this go on. They said, we've got to get rid of him. And in the end, they did get rid of him. There might have been a few people in Jerusalem who were still on his side, but the bulk of the people weren't. And the religious people had a very clever way of manipulating the crowds. After all, the sorts of things that Jesus was saying were not the sorts of things that would appeal to man in general, because most of us don't like to be judged according to what we are within. We like to be judged according to our respectable appearance outside. Here was a man that was coming along and getting beneath the surface the whole time. And most people were not responding to him. So it didn't take much for the leaders to play on vested interests and to go around and say, look, this man is really going to foul up the whole religion. They would then trot out the traditional ideas. They would opt for status quo. And of course, it had a great appeal to the people. And slowly but surely, over the next number of days, they won the people round to their side. They were, of course, helped by one of Jesus' own followers being attracted to them. And it was through him that Jesus was eventually handed over. And so it was an inside job, so to speak, and that enabled them to get hold of Jesus without too much of a disturbance in the city. Then they dragged him before their Jewish council, and the issue on which they judged them was precisely this issue we've been speaking about, and that is that he called himself the Son of God. Eventually they got him to make an open statement that he was indeed the Son of God, and then they said, there you are, blasphemy. Now that's what I said at the beginning, that's the sort of thing that you could expect, isn't it? Because he was a person who was a normal human being and at the same time claiming to be God. And the result was, of course, they accused him of blasphemy. And it was on that charge that they then said he must die, because that was the penalty which their law laid down. But of course they couldn't carry out that penalty because they had no rights in that area. They were under the domination of Rome, and only Rome had the right to carry out the death sentence. And so they took him up to the Roman governor. But they twisted the accusation a bit on the way through. And instead of telling the Roman governor that they had accused him of blasphemy, they told the Roman governor that he had really been stirring up anti-emperor riots around the place, and that he was setting himself up now as a king in opposition to the emperor. Well, that of course would have some clout with the Roman governor, but it was a complete distortion of the facts. But never mind, when people are out to get somebody, they're not really worried about the facts, as long as they can manipulate things so that they can nail the person they want to nail. But the Roman governor was not as silly as they thought he was. He pretty soon saw through them. He realized that this man before him was no political rebel. He also realized that it was a religious matter, and that the real reason why the Jews had brought him was that they were angry with him and they were envious of him. They were envious with the way he was preaching, and some were following him, and they were angry with him for the way he attacked them. The Jews by this time had stirred up such a hornet's nest in Jerusalem that the governor realized that if he was to let Jesus go, then he would have a tremendous riot on his hands. So he was prepared to let Jesus be sacrificed for the sake of keeping a bit of stability in the city. To his shame be it said that he let them crucify the man that he himself knew to be innocent. And so Jesus was taken out and put on the cross. And in that section we read to you, we find that the way he was insulted was again in relation to the fact that he had claimed to be God, because they didn't think God should be the sort of person that he was. They said, no, if you are God, come down from the cross. That's what God should do. God shouldn't just be stuck up there on the cross. If you are God, do that and just zap all the people standing around, let them disappear into thin air, come down from the cross, get your wounds healed and walk out. I mean, that's what God should do. And Jesus hung there. Now, of course, he could, had he wished, he could have called upon umpteen thousands of angels to come and do God's work for him and clean up all the enemy, deliver him, and so on. But he said, no, I won't do that. And so they said, there you are. He reckons he can save others, and he can't even save himself. What sort of a God is that? And although they didn't realize that, there was a certain truth in what they said, but not in the sense that they meant it. Because if Jesus was to save others, then it meant that he would not save himself. He saw it through to the bitter end. He would not save himself, because the purpose for which he was dying was to save others. And of course, if he had have saved himself, then our salvation wouldn't exist. But Jesus allowed himself to suffer the way he did so that he could bear the penalty of sin on our behalf, and in so doing become the saviour of those who want him to be their saviour. And it wasn't only the people who laughed and mocked him like that, But the Jewish leaders, the men from the Jewish council, they came out to see their sentence carried out, and they mocked him with exactly the same words. They said, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. And even the thief on the cross beside him said precisely the same. He said, look, if you are the God that you claim yourself to be, save yourself and save me while you're at it. Come down from the cross and let's get out of here. You see, it was the same message that was coming through. If God was to become man, then he couldn't possibly have been the sort of man Jesus was, because that would be blasphemy. But if he was God, well, then he could do whatever he liked and just, with a click of the fingers, deliver himself from whatever particular trouble he was in. But Jesus, although he was God, was also man, and he was determined to see it through to the end. And in spite of all the temptations that were put in his way by the suggestions of the people, he did not come down from the cross. He did not save himself. When he knew that he had done all that his Father had wanted him to do for the salvation of man, he yielded up his spirit. His dead body hung on the cross there for another 3 hours, from about 3 o'clock in the afternoon to round about sundown. And a couple of his friends, not a couple of his apostles, but a couple of other chaps, in fact there were members of that Jewish council which had condemned him, which indicates that not all on the Jewish council were against Jesus. There were 71 men on that council, and at least two of them we know of were not in favour of the decision. And at least they had the courage to go to the governor and ask permission to take the body down from the cross and give it an honourable burial. In spite of all the insults and the shame that had been heaped upon Jesus, at least there were a couple standing around who wanted to give him an honourable burial. And so they took him down and they placed him in a tomb and went away at least with the feeling that decency had been done at the end of the day. But the Jewish leaders were still a bit bothered over this fact that he had claimed to be Jesus, that he had claimed to be God. And at the back of their minds, it just goes round and round, supposing it was true. Supposing what he claims to be is in fact the truth. That's the uncomfortable impression that goes round the backs of most people's minds. They want to write Christianity off, they want to write God off. But somehow there's the gnawing thing in the back of their minds which just says, but what if it did happen to be true? And that's the part they don't like to think about. And so these Jewish leaders thought, well, this man claims to be God, and he said he was going to rise from the dead. Let's make sure it can't happen. And so their uncomfortable feelings, they try to put at rest by going to the governor and saying, look, could you set a Roman guard at the tomb? Seal it. Make sure he doesn't get out. The governor gave them their wish, and so they set the guard at the tomb. But it was true. That's the whole point. It was true. Death could not keep him inside, and we find that on the Sunday morning, he came back to life. But when he'd come back to life, it wasn't just the resuscitation of a corpse. It was into a new and victorious life, which was in some way different from the life he'd ever known before. And now we find that God highly exalts him. And God gives him a glory and a power that he had been pleased to sacrifice earlier. The glory that he had laid aside, the rights which he had as God, but which he refused to use in his own interests. We find now that all that he was entitled to becomes his. And so God raises him from the dead. And that resurrection from the dead, we are told later on, is the demonstration, above all demonstrations, that he was in fact the Son of God. Because when anybody else dies, he doesn't come back to life again a few days later. Death is one of the consequences of sin. But in the case of Jesus, death could not keep him, it says, because he didn't die as a consequence of any sin that he had done. He died as a consequence of our sin. And to demonstrate the fact that he had not died because of his sin, God raised him from the dead and gave him glory, indicating that this person was no mere man. This person was indeed the Son of God. And so Paul, the greatest of all the Christian teachers in the early church, he then says this of Jesus Christ, that the resurrection was the means whereby God declared him to be the Son of God with power. This same Jesus, says Peter, another of the early leaders, he says, this same Jesus, which you crucified, God has made both Lord and Christ. So the resurrection then is the greatest demonstration you can have that this one who gave his life is in fact the only one who could give his life to pay the penalty of sin. He only could pay the price. The man who was God gave his life so that those who are under the penalty of sin might be forgiven. He makes salvation possible, And because he has now risen from the dead, his followers went around and they preached everywhere and they said, there's no other name under heaven given among men whereby you must be saved. Only through Jesus Christ. That's why the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the core of Christianity. And we can have the assurance of our forgiveness if we have our faith and trust in what Jesus Christ has done for us. We can't trust in what we've done for ourselves, but Jesus has done it all, and we can trust in him. And we can see that his death was the means whereby God dealt with sin, and his resurrection was the means whereby God declared to all that this one is indeed Lord and God. And as we see that, we can join with Thomas, who saw that resurrected Jesus. At first he was a bit doubtful, but then on the next occasion when he did see Jesus, he had nothing more to say except to bow and say, my Lord and my God. And that's what we can do as we look upon Jesus again this morning and see him as the one who gave his life but yet who rose triumphantly, God in the flesh and yet God victorious, declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. We come and we bow before him, and at his feet we confess, my Lord and my God.